Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 185 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, it's Johnny Sunt. In like the last four episodes that I've done, Johnny Sunt's name has come up, so I figured, hey, it was about time. We got him on the line and talked to the man. Professional domestic road racer, cyclocross racer, and now commentator for Flow Bikes. If you're a Flow Bike subscriber, you'll hear his voice doing the Euro races. A difficult job that we talk about in this conversation, but we also get a lot of those great war stories that we've been getting from everybody for the last 4 or 5 weeks since racing has stopped. So again, the goal of this conversation, like the last, you know, since March, has been really just to talk about cool stories from the past, try to get your minds off of what's going on in the world. You know, it's inevitable that we're going to touch on it every once in a while. It just sort of is on the top of everyone's mind, so it comes out. But we try to keep it to a minimum and just have a fun conversation. I think that's what happened here with Johnny on this one. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Works Tools. I got to tell you, I used the driver again to put together some raised beds that we're building in our backyard. Also was able to use the Pegasus table in that as well. I love it. I never thought that, you know, running bike podcasts over at the Wide Angle Podium, that we'd have such a cool sponsor like Works Tool. It started with the Hydro Shot, which is this great pressure washer that is battery powered, and then moved on to the whole slew of tools. So all of us are geeking out on those tools. You can too. We're offering our listeners 15% off of all Hydro Shots, accessories, and everything else. All the other tools that are available at yourcleanbike.com. If you enter the promo code GEARUP, you'll get 15% off of any Hydro Shot item or any of the other items that are on that page, yourcleanbike.com. Enter the code GEARUP. I'm pretty sure that has to be all capital letters. We had a listener with a little issue on that. I went in and tested it. It still works, but GEARUP, GEARUP, one word, at yourcleanbike.com. You get 15% off anything at Works Tools on the yourcleanbike.com page. Lastly, check out wideanglepodium.com. We want you to be part of that community. There are amazing new shows up there every week. Also, part of it is the video show that I'm doing with my Media Pit cohorts, Zach and Mike. And we brought along super rookie Tim from the Slow Ride podcast. We're putting together a 6-7 minute video show for y'all that you can check out at youtube.com/CX Hairs. Would love to get more eyeballs on that. We think it's a lot of fun and something that you will enjoy. Talking to Johnny Sunt, he's got some amazing stories. And we're doing that right now.
I've always wanted to say this on air, and I can't do it in the same velvety deep voice, but hello, cyclocross friends.
That was pretty good. Johnny Sunt, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. You hanging in there?
I am hanging in there. We were chatting a little bit before I hit record, and I was like, wait, stop. We gotta start recording because we're... You know, because if you don't record it, the conversation never happened, right?
Right. Yeah. So for those of you at home, that sound you hear, don't be alarmed. That is Bill scraping the bottom of the barrel for cyclocross content in these trying times.
I don't expect you to be like listening to episodes that I've been putting out, but I will tell you this. Because my thing was like after like the beginning of March, I was like, there are enough people doing really good work covering stuff about what we should be doing in isolation and what's going to happen to the racing schedule and all of that. I feel like that's being covered. And for me, I was like, hey, this is a great opportunity to start catching up on some stories that maybe I missed when we're just, you know, all on it. Cause I came right out of like cyclocross world and was just like, boom, 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 coverage. And then nothing. So I was like, all right. And I started, actually talked to Brad Stoner. He was the first one in this, and because I really wanted just like this behind the scenes of cyclocross nationals and the broadcast, and it was the stories having been behind those scenes. The stories
and,
are just
and what a job, what a great job they did with that. Oh, yeah. I spent a lot of time talking to Tim about it too.
Well, and that was the thing. So I started with Brad, I went to Tim, went to Micah, talked to Zach and Terry out in Seattle, and the name that kept popping up in all of these conversations was Johnny's son. Johnny's
like a son. Bad penny.
Johnny's son. And I'm like, I really need to talk to Johnny's son.
Yeah. How does this guy's name keep popping up? Yeah. It's actually, I listened to the episode with Terry and Zach. It was really great. And, you know, obviously I spent a lot of time. I mean, Terry didn't really go into depth about he briefly said the amateur team that he ran, but that team, I mean, you could do a whole another story just on what was the Broadmark Capital team, became Hoggins Berman, and the riders they developed through that program from the Northwest certainly gave me a stepping stone into the pro road racing ranks. But yeah, it was funny because I was listening to that episode and Terry was talking about how he's sheltering in a small mountain town outside of Seattle. This actually, it's the town called Winthrop where I grew up, okay, where my parents live. So
that's actually what I was going to say, because I know you more as almost like East Coast, and I mean, racing wise, I guess that's just like, and but you know, when we were chatting, I saw the area code and I'm like, oh, that's like Seattle area, right? You know, it's yeah, a Washington area code. So
Northwest, born and raised, man.
Yeah. So where did bikes get into this?
So I grew up in this small mountain town, Winthrop, which is the biggest, has the biggest network of groomed Nordic skiing trails in the Northwest. And so at the age of 14, I was already racing cross-country skiing. So a background, you know, Peter Weber came from, a lot of guys came from Nordic yeah, skiing, and more of the East Coast guys. But certainly I came from a Scandinavian family, so everyone was on Nordic skis from a young, young age. My granddad was a Norwegian freighter captain, actually, so... he's passed, but he had this great stories. But anyway, so it was in my blood. It was definitely the Nordic heritage. But she grew up on skis. That was my athletic background. And the coach said, oh, you should start riding a mountain bike in the summer to, you know, stay fit. And then I got a mountain bike, and I won my first junior race. And I said, this is way more fun, because Nordic skiing is brutal. It's really hard. It's I think they're often referred to as the misery sticks.
Yeah,
it's a painfully hard sport, but I had a good athletic background.
Right, I mean that's what it seems like. Everybody who comes from that, just the VO2 capacity and everything built up from that sport seems to translate really well to bikes.
Yeah, and you know, Seattle was one of the original hotbeds of cross, so I was introduced to cross at a pretty young age, and there was people there to, you know, teach me about it, and we actually had a racing scene. It was very, I mean, I'm sure you've had podcasts about how it used to be before there was a national scene, before there were right, UCI races.
Yeah, yeah,
It was very insular. We used to sit there and race against each other and the Portland guys all year and wait to go battle the East Coast guys. We'd see them once a year at nationals.
Yeah, so, which is interesting to me, because I knew, you know, you through racing cyclocross, but for whatever reason, I always thought of you more as a road racer. And is that really where you sort of started getting success in?
I mean, I came from mountain biking.
Okay.
Mountain bike is still like, I love riding a mountain bike so much. It's, I mean, right now it's just super therapeutic. And it's just, I belong on the trails, but you know, in the term pro on the mountain bike in 96, and it was an Olympic year, and then the bottom sort of fell out of sponsorship on.
Oh, you hit it at the yeah, you hit it at the exact wrong time.
I mean, I missed it completely, like swing and a miss. But and then cross was always there for me. So okay, cross has always been a huge love of mine. But as I went, you know, into my, you know, after that, it was like there were so many opportunities with a certain rider winning the on paper winning the tour a bunch of times and whatnot. There was teams, there was sponsorship, and it's funny that you mentioned Micah, because Micah was running Jittery Joe's, which was my first pro contract.
Right. Well, that's how your name came up from that. Yeah, for yeah, sure. Yeah.
And so, Tim Johnson ended up riding on that team for a year with me as well. And I've known Tim since over 20 years, but yeah. So the road just presented opportunities and a paycheck. And so, yeah, that's where like you probably saw my name more, and I didn't race as much cross as I would have liked to later in those years. But a lot of that was because my role on these small road teams was as a domestique. I did a lot of race days. I wasn't a rider who would go home and prepare for a couple of stage races or this or that. I raced everything.
Yeah, if you go on your pro cycling stats, you can see it is the career of a domestique looking at the results, like tons of race days and all just sort of like did my work and the day's done.
Yeah, domestique. and good time. You know, I was actually chatting via text with Charles Aaron, the principal for Rally Pro Cycling. Just catching up. I've known Charles since before he even had a road team when he was in mountain bikes. I just checked in on how he's doing and how his riders are doing. And he seems to be pretty upbeat despite it being a completely random year for pro cycling.
So here's what I want to like start into cyclocross. And I think the most important race that I see in your cyclocross Palmares is the 2008 race at Rockburn. What the heck were you doing in Rockburn?
I was living in Charlottesville, Virginia at the time.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a deep dive. Jeremiah Bishop won that race, I believe.
No. That was Cap Cross.
Oh, that was Cap Cross.
Yeah. So, which I believe was a UCI race that year. So that was like okay, but Rockburn, which is an amazing venue, great race, but it's like, you know, it was Mabra Cross at that time, just local race.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, up in Maryland. You got fourth, and Bad Andy Wolfke ended up winning that race. I was in the 35 plus 3-4 race, a disappointing 28th that day.
Or a solid 28th, depending on how you look at it. Yeah, I do remember that race. It was very fast. It was a little further than I wanted to drive for an off-season cross race. I was living in Charlottesville at the time. It was something to do.
I just felt I thought that was funny because that was my local race that I'm like
about that race in years. there's such a good scene out there. So many good races in that area though.
Yeah, well, that's my area, and you know what I always joke about with the series that we have here. It's like the biggest series no one ever heard of. You know, at this point, you know, in the heyday, we're getting 600-700 people on a race day, and it's, you know, just local race,
in 2001, maybe, or 2002, it was one of those years. I had a knockdown drag out battle with Mark Gullickson at Monkey Hill.
Oh yeah, Monkey Hill, man. Yeah.
And it was the most disappointing second place I've ever gotten in my life. And it was, I had him on the ropes, and he makes that cobbled climb was just tough, even on a cross bike. And I had him. I was like, in, you know, Todd Wells was in the race, his teammate, and then they're trying to tag team. We got rid of Wells, and I've got him. I'm like, we're coming into the final lap. I'm like, this guy's, he can't go with me up the cobbles. I'm going to destroy him. And he attacks me on the last lap in this fast grassy corner, immediately washes out, dumps the bike. I go over the top of his bike, and his canty cuts my rear tubular.
Ugh.
So I'm riding a flat. He gets up, no problem, comes by me, and he's just like, I'm really sorry. And he proceeds to go and win the race.
Super Cup Boston. You came in fourth behind Gullickson, but the winner was Erwin Vervaeken.
Yep, I remember because I attacked Erwin on the first lap, like really, really smart move, just absolutely right, it was in Gloucester, right?
Were you trying to splatter some mud on that all white world champ skin suit?
No, it was purely just just youthful hubris, and that the funny thing is that shot of me attacking Vervaeken in his world championship kit with Tim in the background, and I was riding for K2 bikes. I was helping them design their new cross bike that year, and that was their catalog copy. I have a catalog somewhere with like that picture. I'm like, well, I'm leading at the time. I was good, but I paid dearly for that effort.
Yeah, if they gave you any money in sponsorship, it was all worth it for that photo.
Right there, yeah. And Erwin, such a good dude. And he did so much with him. He was the first one to really embrace coming over to the US and helping grow put the footprint of pro cycling firmly in cyclocross here.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. That little tour that he did that year was just crazy. I mean, we didn't see anything like that for years. And
briefly, after I stopped racing for a living in 2011, I helped Raleigh start the little cross program that eventually became Raleigh Clement.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just Raleigh that year. So I luckily Sally, who was working for Raleigh, Brian Forrest, gave me a job, and after that I moved on to working in sales in the bike industry, but so, never having to make that drive.
Yeah. So you weren't, were you, was Ben Burden on the team at that point? Or was that?
No, he was, it was the next year. So I ran that team the first year. It was just Raleigh. And,
okay. So it was before.
And then they were going to actually create a position for me at the company so I could keep running the team and do probably demo driving. But I got a job with QVP as their rep for Texas and Oklahoma, which was a great opportunity. I basically, with no experience, talked my way into a really good industry job. And so as I left, I actually called Don Kellogg to broker the deal to merge those teams together. And it turned into, I mean, that had a really long run. It's a very successful program. And it's still, I mean, it's still going, and it's not with Raleigh anymore.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that kind of was the last sort of heyday of, I don't know if heyday is the right word. That's when the paradigm of cyclocross in the U.S. was teams, which has kind of gone away a little bit, you know, even...
Yeah.
Going forward, I don't know what we're going to see as far as like full on teams.
Yeah, go. I mean, it's like right now it's like, do we even sit here and start speculating on how it's going to look?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, we know like Hyde isn't on Cyclocross World anymore. So even that sort of, who knows what Stu's doing. And of course, and again, this is the stuff I didn't want to get into because it's speculating on stuff. We just,
I mean, you've been sitting here asking everybody how they're going to fix cyclocross. And if it comes to my turn, I'm like, nobody knows, man. I mean, I don't have any races to commentate on, you know. It's, Flow Bikes is pretty much, I mean, one of the big things for Flow Bikes this year is that we had the U.S. exclusive rights to the Giro d'Italia.
Oh, yeah.
And I was going to be doing a lot of extra content for that because Ian and Michael were going to be in Italy. Obviously, we put a lot of effort into it. And so I was slated to have a lot of work doing Telestrator work and in-office stuff. And learning how to use Telestrator has been super fun. By the way, it's going to be, if we have Cross this year, I'm going to be able to put together some really, really cool stuff.
I love it.
You know, slow down and draw pictures on stuff and neat stuff like that. Oh, but
you know, the Svennis video started like that for me. It was like it was, you know, growing up playing basketball, being in the, you know, having a game, having to go back, watch game tape, having a coach there, drawing on clipboards and penciling on the video as we watched it. And I just love that stuff. I was like, nobody does that in bike racing.
Yeah, no, it's, Svennis is obviously, I draw all my inspiration from that when it comes to doing that stuff. It's something that was like when you started doing that, it was so needed. And I come from a sports background. I wasn't just I played baseball a lot when I was younger. And I like ball sports too. So, I'm a fan. And, you know, I think the whole country is, it's not just bike racers that are missing their cycling fans that are missing their bike racing. It's everybody.
Oh yeah.
And,
for sure.
You know, it's more than just, I mean, obviously as cyclists, we're super into ourselves and we're a very self-centered bunch. And to be good at bike racing, you have to be pretty selfish actually at a top level. But
did you do much before you started working for Flow Bikes and doing the on-air stuff? Did you do much bike, like race commentating, race announcing?
No, I got a call from Ian Dilley and said, do you want to try this? Because they had bought the rights to all these Euro races. And think that probably after they'd secured the rights, they realized there was no English commentary. They were like, oh yeah, just send us the English feed. And they're like, it's not possible, huh? And so I took to it naturally, but I really have had to learn it on my own.
And it's especially jumping in, because I mean, sometimes you and Ian will be there together, but a lot of times it's just you solo. And that is a tough gig. I mean, I know Anthony McCrossing gets a ton of crap for his commentating because he's like talking about everything and then he goes back into his track background and everything else and people get upset about it. I'm like, man, 60 minutes of, you know, Matthew Vanderpool out there on his own is not easy to
talk
about.
Those are the fun ones, yeah. You know, so I think it's like if you have multiple personalities, it's good because you're your own color commentary. But no, I talk really fast naturally. I have to make myself slow down. So it's little things. If you're by yourself, it's okay just to shut up for a minute. I mean, not for too long. I mean, 15 seconds of dead air seems like an absolute eternity when you're doing live broadcast. And it's just, you know, when we're doing European races live, I'm in the studio at 6 a.m.
Right.
And it's actually in Flow, because Flow Bikes is more than just Flow Bikes. It's Flow Sports. There's 40 different verticals. These are massive offices. It's kind of creepy in there. It's all empty at 6 in the morning. with one producer. But I was sort of forced how to learn how to do it on my own. Because I remember texting with Powers, and he's like, "You do that on your own?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "That's terrifying." I'm like, "It is. It absolutely is." But you know, as a huge cyclocross fan, and as someone who's always been a course nerd, because I've never been the strongest guy in a race, so relying in cyclocross is an amazing sport, because you can beat guys that are way stronger than you if you can outride, or you, course management is a big one. I use it. You can manage your effort, manage the course better, courses evolve. And because so much of our audience in the U.S., Flow Bike's audience, and the U.S. cyclocross fan in general, also race cyclocross. It's very different from the European
for sure
dynamic. I'd say probably a good 90%+ of the people who are watching Flow Sports, Flow Bikes in the morning for cross are people that actually race cross. And so I allow myself to be a little bit more of a nerd and not sitting there trying to tell people how to race a bike. But if you start pointing things out, like, watch that rut on next lap. You know, and it's, I sometimes I feel like I'm going a little far down the rabbit hole of being a total like course nerd. And, but then people seem to like it. And it's,
no, that's, you can, I mean, that's your, you know, preaching to the choir on that one. And that's the stuff that I love. And that's what I think that sometimes these other, sort of the UCI broadcast, World Cup broadcast, kind of dumb it down too much, where I think that you do have that audience. And if somebody's going to put forth the money to subscribe to Flow Bikes, they're going to be a little more sophisticated race fan than just somebody who's flipping the channel. Do we have people even flip channels anymore? Who's just sort of finds it?
Yeah, that's what I think, that's what we're going for. And the feedback I've gotten, not just from people watching, but people at Flow Bikes, are like, this is, keep doing what you're doing. This is on brand. I would love to have someone else in the booth with me there more often. Hopefully we can work out the technology, maybe bring someone in remotely, like some other people do. We have such good studios. We're so spoiled. Like the if you need to come down and hang
out. Yeah, I know. I want a tour.
But having, I mean, with a lot of the races we're doing, we do a little bit on air, on camera before and a little bit after. We have access to such good equipment and such beautiful studio space. It's like, I'm like, let's use it. Let's go on camera. Let's do this stuff. Let's make it a show. And it's resources. And so a lot of times I'm just by myself in a little whisper room, making the content for our loyal subscribers. But the by yourself thing was a learning curve, but I just got thrown in the deep end. So it's, what are you gonna do? Not do it?
Yeah. Any standout races for you from the past season?
Man, it's all the elite women's races that I got to. In fact, I did a little telespirator bit on, it was Holst actually, the one, late season, but it was a last lap battle between, Alvarado and Wurst. Alvarado got her on the last lap, but I broke it down. I did a telespirator clip. You can go, if you're on Flow Sports, look at it. And it came down to like maybe 30 seconds of critical moments in the last lap. But those two put together, there were so many battles. And then I think the day before was a Super Prestige that, honestly, there were so many good elite women's races this year. I probably can't pick one out for you, because every time I saw one of these battles go down, I'm like, well, we're not going to see that again. That race was the elite women's start was delayed because a tree blew down across
the
course.
That's right. Yeah.
They were having super windy conditions, and we sort of had to I said, well, we'll come back when we come back. And we, I went into the booth, and the producer was there, and I was like, hey, you know, I don't know. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee and keep an eye on it. And we'll just, we'll do what we do it. Cause you know, when we're doing these live races from Europe, we're getting the stream from the Euros.
Right.
So we have no control. We don't really, sometimes I get a runner show, which has the breakdown of when they're going to what cuts, like before and after the race. And they always go off script, like every time.
Yeah.
After the race, you know, they were like, so the, you know, post the, was the, one of the races that it was Wout's, not his first comeback race, but one of his races where Wout Van Aert was there. And on the piece of paper I printed out that they had emailed to me as a run of show. So that, you know, after the elite women's race, we'll see interviews with top three. We'll have, you know, this scenery shot, podium presentation. But then the camera crew just ran across Wout coming out of his bus, and the plan went out the window.
For sure. Yeah.
I was like, well, we're gonna.
I was there for that time. Like it might have been even like Hulam. That guy, it's amazing. It's just amazing. Even for him, just, you know, not winning races, the love that guy gets compared to anybody else out there is just, it truly is just rock star level. It's just, and it's him. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, obviously he's hugely successful. And I think what he did on the road helped a ton, and just his world championships, but just him as a person, I think he's just one of those guys that just draws people to him.
For sure. And he has a great, rival, and then there's such a good story there. I mean, I remember his first race back in Lonehout, and he's coming through I guess the Euros call him the washboard. We like to call him whoops here, motocross, but it's coming through the washboard. And I was just like, I was doing a live, And I was like, let's just listen to this. I just stopped talking because the crowd was going absolutely nuts.
I got the chance to be at Belgian Nationals, which was insane. It was great. It was like, let's take advantage of the resources I have. So I got like media credentials so I could get good parking and just have that access. And then at the finish line, you know, just career defining moment for Lauren Swick, you know, just the race, basically he can do no wrong from here. He's tapped out. He's won the Belgian national championship. He crosses over the line, you know, he rolls by there. The media is all like running down there. And then within a minute, you know, fifth place rolls across and it's a Wout, and like, Swick couldn't have been on a deserted island. Like, this is the winner of the Belgian national championship, the biggest potentially bigger than worlds. And just nobody cared about him as soon as Wout crossed the line. It was like every TV camera, every photographer just sprinting towards Wout.
Yep. It was just... Yeah. I remember it. Just that makes me think of a tour of Georgia in, I think, 2004. And there was the race program. I mean, I don't know if you ever really spent much time back then following the Tour of Georgia. It was a big deal.
Oh, no, I did. Yeah, I love that.
And so in 04, I mean, obviously Jittery Joe's was the local team. But so on the cover of the race program, which is this thick magazine, glossy, there's three photos. And one is he who shall not be named, because he was racing the race that year. And then Mark McCormick and me. There's three photos side by side by side. And so like the entire race, I'm getting asked to sign the cover of these programs. Everyone's like, oh, that's him. That's the random guy from Jittery Joe's. He's not Cesar. So we're at a stage start. We got the chairs out because we didn't have a big tour bus. So we're sitting in our camp chairs, like a proper Conti team. And people come up and they're like, oh, can you sign this? I'm sitting there, Sharpie in hand. And I'm like, through the J on the cover. And he rides by, and this person just snatches the program out of my hand, and it goes running off down the road. I'm sitting there holding my Sharpie, and the entire team is just losing it, laughing at it.
Oh, that is great.
And I mean, not quite like not Swake level, because he just won a national championship. But it reminded me of that story.
I would pay money for that program right now, just with LA's autograph on it, and then just
and
the J and just the line across the whole thing.
Probably ruined the whole cover. Anyway.
That is awesome. So Tour of Georgia was one of those things, because that, I mean, I must have, it was what, like 2000 and 2005, right? 2004, around there.
Yeah, I did it 3, 4, and 5.
Was it on OLN? Where was I watching this?
I think that was the go back then.
Yeah.
That was probably, was that pre-NBC Sports taking over a lot of,
I think so.
Cycling?
It was either Versus or something like that. But those were those were such big races, and the climbs up Baldy and everything. Those were classic. That's
good stuff.
Yeah. Talking about how that
birthed the Tour of Missouri, which then birthed the Tour of California. Now they're all gone because apparently it's a model that only lasts for so many years. Yeah, you use state tourism money to bring in a tour like that. But I wanted to say, because before we went down this rabbit hole, we were talking about flow sports, and then you're talking about how people, it's nice that people aren't dumbing it down. We've had that problem in cyclocross coverage, especially for the U.S., is we dumb it down too much. And that's something, I don't know if you watched the coverage of the first World Cup or the second World Cup at Waterloo when Tim Johnson and I did the commentary. When you were there, I saw you that day.
Yeah, I wasn't watching because I was running right. around in that damn
You were running in sandals with no socks on.
Yeah, that lasted. I was like, I'm a genius here because my shoes are going to be ruined anyway. And that lasted maybe 5 minutes before that suction just started, you know, happening between my foot and the
jeans. I mean, it seemed like a good idea when I was like tiptoeing, trying not to ruin my sneakers. And I'm like, oh, Bill's got it. It guy's a pro.
Yeah, no, I had the boots on by the time the races start.
Yeah, that race. So Tim, you know, obviously they brought me in on loan from Flo, and Tim has done. He did the first one as the co-commentator. So we sort of made a conscious decision that we weren't going to dumb it down. That we were going to do it win, lose, or draw. We were going to do it for the people that we knew would appreciate that, and it turned out, I think, really good.
Yeah, I think
all the feedback we got.
Yeah, and that sort of goes along with, you know, the conversation that I was having previous with Tim and Brad and, you know, Meredith in there in Georgia before her, and just the Nationals broadcaster the same way. And I think it's something that the fans in the U.S. appreciate. And it's kind of like, what are you going to do? I mean, are we, and this is the conversation that I have with people too, where they're like, oh, well, we need to have cyclocross have a broader appeal. But I think that's a balancing act that sort of weighs against that, in that it's easy enough to watch a couple races and pick up what's going on. But I don't think if you do this just general top level analysis that anybody's happy, because the people you're talking to know so much more, and anybody else that comes into it usually is with a friend or whatever else, and they can sort of get that information there. And I don't think it, you know, we're not going to be hockey, you know, we're not going to be basketball. And even
to that, like, if you watch those sports, they don't dumb it down that much because they expect an educated, and, you know, also like what's catered to the customer. Like the best customer you can get is the customer you already have. Like, let's do content for the people who are already invested, the stakeholders, if you will, of our sport, which are the people, for me, it's the people who are paying for a Flo Bike subscription.
Yeah.
They don't need me to explain. I mean, you know, if you watch NFL football, like, they don't sit there and break down what offsides is in a detailed manner and explain it every time. You know, if you're sitting there on your couch and you don't know what this is, like, you know, ask your girlfriend. She'll tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. And
like,
it's,
you know, no one watches cyclocross who has no clue. I mean, there are probably people out there, but you're generally brought into it by somebody. But, you know, our stakeholders are the people who are invested in this sport, and they deserve better than have Cross 101 explained to them every time they tune in to watch a race.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Just the basics of it, how timing works, how all that, you don't have to go into. And that's the thing too. I think in the end, and why we all love it, is it's pretty intuitive. You know, it's the person who is strongest and can handle their bike the best, who makes the least amount of mistakes, who's going to win the race, you know. And that's, it's like figuring out who that person is and what's going to happen. And it's those dynamics that make it fun and exciting. And for me, what I think is the other thing that makes cyclocross really exciting, and I'd even like to see that, you know, I'm always a proponent of taking the 60 plus men's race and bumping them down to 50 minutes and bumping the women's up to 50 minutes and just having that it. So it's just like, you know, head to the chin to the stem the whole time and just going all out instead of this, you know, oh, we got two laps to go, we're going to sit up and regroup and see where everybody's at and then go for the end. But That's where I see the sport. That's sort of the sweet spot for me for cycling sports. And that's how you saw, like, cross country mountain biking has done the same. You know, I mean, we can either give credit to or blame Red Bull for this, for kind of reinventing cross country mountain biking. But when you were racing it, you know, what is now a marathon race was your cross country race. It was like 3-4 hours in the woods.
You know? Yeah, pretty darn close. And they each have their own appeal, but that's why you have, I mean, in just locally in Texas, we have a cross country series and we have a marathon series, and, you know, a lot of people race both. Some people have one they prefer.
Yeah. But it's like, as far as like making it into a TV sport, making it into a spectator sport, I used to announce you know, cross country mountain bike races in the Mid-Atlantic, you know, a decade ago. And it was like, you talk at the start, you get to see them when they come through one of their three laps. And then what the job was you were hired to announce, because it's mountain biking, the 180 different podium presentations on the day.
Right.
And that's basically after that first race finished, that's all you were doing for the rest of the day was just announcing podiums, because the race action wasn't there.
And you're herding cats, you're getting people to their podium, you're announcing that, you're running through it. And
but now you got, you know, you look at World Cup mountain biking, you got 10-minute laps, you know, they're running 6-7 laps, and it looks a lot like a cyclocross race with suspension.
Yeah. No, and it's, I think I like the format. There's a lot of, in a lot of ways, I think that format killed off a lot of local participation. And if when people tried to bring the World Cup format to local racing, the races were too short. There was too many laps. Obviously, you can't run multiple categories on the course at the same time. There's still a place for proper old school XC racing, I believe. But as far as this, I mean, and there's people that will be like, nope, the UCI killed cross country mountain bike racing. It's dumb. It's ruined. But the bottom line, it's good on TV, which is the lifeblood of a sport, and it's entertaining for the fans.
You know, what do you think about this? So I think that brings up a really interesting parallel in that what we see sometimes. Well, we saw it definitely in road racing where people just, they get into it, they get shelled, they, you know, be lapped in a crit after like lap three because they're in a, you know, cat five race with guys who should be cat twos. And, you know, same with road races, you know, you lose the group and you're just out there on your own for who knows how many hours as an amateur. It's no fun. So a lot of those people were like, okay, I'm going to go race cyclocross. This looks like a lot of fun. And it's the same thing. You get good, you get upgraded, and then you're in that same position where, you know, lap three and you look behind and crap, here comes the leaders. I'm going to get lapped. And then they move on. And now we're seeing this sort of shift to gravel racing. And what I see gravel, and that's something where, sure, those guys can go crush it in the beginning. We're going to love to see what happened later with the highlights, but we're doing our own race, you know, a couple hours back and going to be able to finish it off and have a good time and have something that's an accomplishment. I see what you're talking about with mountain biking, that can be a return to mountain biking, because that's more of the experience you get when it's not that World Cup format, when it is, you know, an hour lap that you're not seeing, you know, the leaders come up behind you anytime during the race. It's just not going to happen there. And that's, so you get that full experience without feeling bad about yourself that you suck at the end. You still get to have a good race.
Yeah. And it's the cyclical part of it, because remember all the kids riding fixies found cyclocross bikes and they're like, this is the new thing. And then they started racing cross and they're like, wow, cross is really freaking hard. And so, and we saw a lot of those people bleed over into gravel now. And now people are putting bigger tires on their gravel bikes and they're like, oh, I'm right. And they're like posting on Instagram, like shredding these trails on my gravel bike. And you're like, you know, once that tire becomes that big, and it's, you pretty much have a 90s era mountain bike now. and then all these people are like, got my first hardtail, like mountain bikes are cool. And like, so I hope, and gravel has its own thing, obviously, because it's the mullet of bike racing. It's, you know, business in front, party in the rear. People are doing gravel races that never would have ever pinned a number on for any discipline. So it's getting participation, because it is riding a gravel road for someone like you or I is not that big of an accomplishment. But there's a lot of people that, like, that first gravel event was an absolute adventure, and it's and there's a place for all those people in that event, and it's helping participation. But I think that you'll see the people who are starting to race gravel that maybe came from fixies to cross to gravel, they've never actually experienced how awesome a cross country mountain bike race can be.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll see more participation come there.
Yeah.
If you're putting fat tires on your gravel bike and you're thinking about maybe putting a flat bar on it because, you know, just to make it a little more shreddy, like, hey, guess what, pal? You're a mountain biker now.
Exactly. You know, and they got, and Nika, I think, has done a great job of bringing that participation up. I think once that generation, you know, we already have that generation, you know, you already got Kate Courtney who came out of that scene, you know, but once more of that moves in and they start becoming adults or older adults, that I think that cross country scene may continue to grow. One of the funny things I love about talking about like fat tires versus skinny tires, where like my roadie friends are always like, oh, cyclocross, I don't want to put that, you know, those big tires. I'm like, you know that 33 millimeters now is the biggest tire you can have on cyclocross. Your road tires at this point are fatter than that. I mean, there's no difference, you know, width-wise between road and cyclocross.
I was riding cross tires on a bike and went out and rode the group and we hit some gravel and everyone was like, how are you riding such tall, small tires? And I was like, actually, these are fine.
And they're made for this.
Yeah, this is what I do. So there's a whole, I mean, now it's like people are like, anything less than 35, you're just doing it wrong.
Yeah. Okay. So you're talking about the Fixie Messenger crowd. You spent a little time in there.
Yeah.
When was that?
I mean, I never really rode a Fixie because I was a messenger in Seattle. Like, well, this was like early 90s, so like a long, long time ago. And so Seattle is pretty much all on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
So the Fixies were more trendy for that city. And that was a little, actually, Fixies weren't really a thing when I was a messenger. That came a little bit later in that. When messengers became cool, I think when I was a messenger, we were dirtbags. So,
should be.
Yeah, that's, but then, you know, barely being a dirtbag became, cool. or trendy or whatnot. But I rode a road bike with fenders to Seattle, most of the time. And I actually was lucky enough to work for a company that let me. As I started racing more, let me work part time. But you can't, once you start getting to a certain level of bike racing, being a messenger is really, really bad for your recovery and just your ability to keep going and not burn yourself out.
So I was about to do the horrible thing. So that was in Seattle. I was about to bring up a Portland thing. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, no, it's okay. I was their number one bad guy in Portland. So I'm really good friends with a lot of the people that, used to put on Cross Crusade and still are involved. And I've known Eric Tonkin for forever. But they like to play me up as the bad guy there.
How so? Talk to me about this. So this is,
so we just created a, it's always been a good rivalry and less so in the recent years, I think, because, there's not as many of the like pro level or fast guys coming out of that region right now or living there or based out of there. But we used to have this big rivalry between Seattle and Portland. We had that keg grail that went missing for years and all that stuff. And it was really fun.
People don't know about that. Give us a little background.
That's a whole nother story. But basically it was a keg that had been turned into a trophy and had a reversible top, and one side had a Space Needle and one side had a Crusader.
Amazing.
So it was basically we had a point series and whoever was leading got to hold the trophy. And then people started, like, part of the rules, you could actually steal it. And it turned into it devolved really, really badly. the thing went missing for years, ended up in the river apparently. Like, there's someone else who can tell this story better. That got washed up downstream. Like, someone found it and knew what it was. I mean, there's a whole other story behind that thing.
That's like a documentary series that needs to happen.
Oh, could be for sure. But I mean, anyway, the inner city rivalry between Seattle and Portland was a really big part of Cross for so many years. And in Portland, I was I played the role of the bad guy. I was the bad guy from Seattle. I was the one that everyone loved to hate. And even though, and like, so people look in the surface like, man, they really hate you down there. But in reality, the promoters are some really good friends of mine, and just like it was for the show.
Yeah.
And so I would actually, I'd get a little extra spicy towards them and, talk a little shit, and it created a good scene.
That must have been great to race in too. I mean, you don't get that as, of course, you see that in Belgium a little bit and it just gets, it's weird, but sort of that fun, having the bad guy out there to boo. I mean, that's gotta be fun as a racer. And then just that scene has to be amazing.
Yeah, you go to Portland and like it was like I was the bad guy and people were like, oh, we hate him. But then I would go have dinner and drinks with the promoters of the Cross Crusade or whatever. Then you go to New England and they actually really just hate you.
Yeah, it's definitely a different scene up there.
and I spent a lot of time racing in New England, and that's probably where you had that thought that I was maybe a New England guy, because there were so many more UCI races. They started becoming more prevalent. I spent a lot of time in New England. I'd go out there for a month or two during the first part of cross season.
Yeah. What's some favorite memories from those races? I know you did the whole, it was by Verge at that point, Gloucester, Providence, all of those. even anything really stand out from just racing that you're looking back on?
Well, I mean, the only UCI race I ever won was the opener of that Verge series in 2001.
Oh, nice.
So that was the one pro victory I got on a cross bike. And I got to victimize Timmy Johnson for that one, which
and
Mark McCormick.
You can pretty much, you know, between that and the photo of you, ahead of Vervecken. I mean, that's like a career in cyclocross.
I should have just called it in 2001. I'd be probably a different place in life right now. If I had known, Bill, that was the zenith in my career, it would have saved me so much hard work and heartache. But no, here I am. I was homeschooled for a lot of my youth. And so I'm having a pretty good chuckle over this whole thing because parents are absolutely losing their shit right now having to homeschool their kids.
Yeah.
And my mom is sitting up there. My mom homeschooled five different kids for some or all of their primary education. And she's sitting there sipping a glass of wine, just having a chuckle right now. She's like, oh, it's so hard. Ooh-hoo. So she's having her moment right now.
Yeah.
But and homeschooled mostly because of I grew up off the grid in the mountains of North Central Washington, where it was 8 miles of gravel road. I was riding gravel before it was cool. And then the last 3 miles, we actually had to snowmobile in the wintertime to get to the house.
What did your parents do? I mean, what?
My dad's a cabinet maker.
Okay.
And a builder. That's why I learned how to make, be handy with a table saw and not cut my fingers off, and build floating shelves, which is the project right now. But I can send you, if you got a drill and a saw, I can send you this a really quick how to make nice floating shelves.
I think you should. I can post that because, this is where we're at right now, where our cyclocross content is Johnny's son teaching us how to build shelves. I'm 100% into that.
You know who, and this will be a blast for the past, who's an amazing woodworker now is Zach McDonald.
Yes. I just saw his, Zach McDonald on his Instagram feed, RunZMD, his past two posts. One was, this is a good day for me. I'm finally off the whereabouts list. Nobody has to know where I'm at anymore. I'm retired as a racer. And that was 2 years ago. And then just within the last week, it's this beautiful wood console that he has built and was on there. Yeah.
Yeah. Zach is good at things.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he went through that whole thing where he was going to be aerospace engineer, doctor, all this list of high-end education stuff. He always struck me as too smart for cyclocross.
Yeah, too smart to be a bike racer. I mean, I think Phil Guymon falls into that category in a lot of ways too. He's like, man, you're just too smart for this. Go do something else. Or I mean, Phil's still going to he's still using cycling as a primary source of income. So he's smarter than the rest of us.
Right. He's still making it work now.
Yeah. I mean, and the whole thing, sponsorship is everything is just a question mark right now. And it was funny because I had a long conversation with Tyler Cloutier. We were just brainstorming on sponsorship. And I'm a huge Tyler Cloutier fan. I think we need more. U.S. domestic cross racing needs more of him.
Yeah.
We don't just need three fast guys battling out. We need a field of guys who travel around. It can't just be Kerry and Steven and Curtis flying around the country just beating up on the local guys. That doesn't make a good pro scene. And obviously, there's a whole other conversation of how that looks. And I'm not gonna dip my toe into that pool right now. I know that's how you. You always ask people how they're going to fix it. And I don't know if I want to play this game.
Come on. You brought it up twice already now, how you don't know. So how are you going to fix it?
How are we going to fix it? Let's make sure we have it still.
Yeah.
And then we'll go from there. I mean, you always ask questions what about you, Bill? What would you do to fix pro cyclocross?
This is why I ask the questions. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I think I know what it's not. And I understand the, US is enormous. And for me, it's not even US. I always throw Canada in there as well. I think we are North America's one racing entity. And I don't think you can have different series. I think it has to be the best of the best racing against each other for at least 8 weekends a year. And if that's all it is, then that's fine. And then you can break it down a regional stuff, whatever. I think that USGP was amazing. It was great when it was there, you know, even the, you know, NACT also great, but it stopped, right? It lost sponsorship. It ended. The model broke down. So it wasn't like this, you know, oh gosh, if we just go back to that, everything's going to be fine.
Right. It's just, and we have, you know, the stakeholders in those events that are still very involved in cycling. Everyone has, you know, the things they hold on to that, cause those were all great. Everyone did the right stuff in their own ways, you know, and it's how do we take the good elements for all those or keep it going? And a lot of it is probably, one, our country is too big. It just comes down to that. And it's like, we don't really want Big Brother. We don't want the UCI to have to step in and say, okay, you know what? The US is two regions. Yeah. I'm a huge Supercross fan. I love motocross bikes. And I don't think this model necessarily works, but one of the things they do in Supercross, something to think about, is the 450s, the big guys, they race the whole circuit. But in the Moto 2 or the 250s, they have a West Coast and East Coast. And those guys don't travel to the other coast. And then they have a couple races where they all get together at the end for the championship. But there's a championship red plate for both the West Coast and the East Coast for the 250 guys.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. But I do think those ones at the top need to race together. I mean, what it comes down to is that, God, I'm getting in trouble for saying this way, no. But it's not a professional sport. So therefore, all of the people who race it, and it's no fault of them, they are amazing athletes, but they don't have the means to do that. I mean, more than three or four or five of them in the country don't have the means to do that. And until you get to that point, you can't have that participation. And the problem too is that the incentive, if you are a bike racer who has talent and you race cyclocross and you're great at it, if you truly have talent as a bike racer, there are other ways for you to make a living racing your bike. You know, we can look at Emma White. We can look at Joe Dombrowski, you know, one that was in that Rockburn race that you raced when he was probably like 10 years old, but racing in the elites. And, you know, it ended up, oh, hey, this guy is like a world-class road racer, started on his mountain bike, started on a cyclocross bike, but he's not going to stay in it because he's, you know, he went off to Sky and made like six figures. He's not going to be racing domestic cross.
For a U.S. talented rider, cross is not the path of least resistance to make a living in cycling. It's right. Just not.
Right.
And it's, we have to, but it's not even about the top guys, because we're going to, even in Europe, cross will bleed off top talent. It's a fact of life. It's the economy of the whole thing. It's people have these careers. They know it's a finite thing, but it's not our job to cater to those top guys. If we have a proper national series, those guys will show up. Their teams will make them show up. Their teams will be there. We just have to create a sustainable way to keep. We need to be very judicious where they allow Cat 1 races to be, and they need to be distributed properly. If you bring the top U.S. racers to a region, anywhere around the U.S., the locals, the guys who race the local level, they're going to see a level of racing they don't normally get. And so it is there. It's scalable in some ways. I think, I mean, ultimately, all this comes down to money, right? If I had a budget to say, okay, you know, we need a Cat 1 in every region, but if you're awarded one of these Cat 1s and it's evenly distributed and it works, the schedule works, we're going to give you an extra 10, 20, 30,000 towards you putting on this race at this level. Well, that's an easy fix. You throw money at stuff, it works. It's just that it's more of a cash poor sport, and especially going forward in these uncertain times. We don't know what anything's going to look like. We don't know what teams will be around. We don't know what races are going to be around. And I hate that I know you didn't really want to get into this, but it's the elephant in the room right now is we're talking about a sport, about fixing a sport that we have to make sure it's still around. And this might be, you know, it seems like right now in general in cycling, it's the entire economy of pro cycling is based on some trickle down from the Tour de France, from everything you're seeing from the UCI and the powers that be. And they're trying to like push these grand tours into the late year, which is absolutely going to crap all over pro cyclocross in a year where they're trying to expand the World Cup.
Yeah.
And in reality, we don't even really know at this point if we'll actually be ready to start having bike races again in the fall.
Yeah. And that's, and my response to a lot of that where I'm hearing this, and I agree, and I don't, you know, it's not to get too far into it, but until you have mass testing or even some sort of vaccine or something where you know that people you're racing against aren't going to infect you, then I don't see how you do it, or spectators
and also like spectators else. It's and we're racing in empty fields. American crossers are much better at that than anyone else in the world.
Yeah, for sure. But the
wait, no spectators, no problem.
On the other side of that, you know, people are talking about, oh, well, now road cycling is going to just be taking over on where cyclocross was and that kind of thing. And in a rare moment of glass half full for me, I will say, it's going to be nuts. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be frustrating. It's going to be chaotic. But if it happens, oh, it's going to be so much fun. I mean,
it's going to be absolutely out of control.
That just thrown together is just going to be a huge mess that I think we're going to look back on and be like, holy cow, they were racing the Vuelta at the same time they're racing Coxida and everything, you know, and it's just like, everything's just going to be thrown into this frenzy that I hope we get to. I hope it happens. You know, that's the thing. And then a year from now, it's all going to be like, well, it'll all settle out.
And
we'll
no one will ever complain about schedule conflicts ever again after this fall if we actually race bikes. I mean, I'm actually very proud because generally speaking, I haven't seen pro cyclists complaining too much.
Mm-hmm.
And because they still have one of the best jobs in the world and people are being cool. And I was talking to Charles Aaron about this and I'm going to just sort of paraphrase his quote. He's like, hey, I was like, how are your riders doing? You know, I mean, how's everyone holding? He's like, they're fine. He's like, you know, I pay my guys well, my gal as well. Women, gals. That was me paraphrasing. Charles is very good. He's like, I pay my riders very well. And, he said, and they're professionals. I expect them to be fit and ready to go. It's not a vacation year, but, you know, we're just going to get through this. And it was really nice to hear that perspective as a top-down attitude from that organization. And I was, you know, just thinking about that. And my, like, if anyone's complaining, like, you should remind them of who Fausto Coppi is.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy won his first Giro and then immediately got cast into World War II, conscripted to fight on the losing side.
Yeah.
Spent the last part of the war in an internment camp on the losing side. So didn't come home as a war hero. It wasn't like, oh, you gave up 3 years of your career to fight the fascists. They're like, oh, you gave up 3 years of your career to be a fascist or fight for them and end up in a prison camp. But and he never, his gut was never the same. He had some dysentery or something that haunted him the rest of his career. But he just got back to it and went back to being a pro cyclist.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, if anyone complains, just remind him of old Fausto.
What I would say is that the one thing, getting back to the schedule, that I was actually like the chaos of it all, and I'm just looking at if all of these events happen where they're supposed to happen, I'm kind of geeking out on covering the cross country race on Thursday at Sea Otter, getting on a plane and going to Trek for the World Cup race. I mean, it's an adventure. I mean, I just think that's going to be fun, and that's the kind of stuff that I'm looking forward to in this compressed season.
I don't know if I'm going to get the call to do the commentary there for the television. I hope so. I think Tim and I did a great job last year. I'd love to go back, but I'll be there regardless. So.
Nice, excellent.
Yeah.
All right, we are just at an hour, and
perfect.
I'm glad we got the chance to catch up. Yeah, man.
Thanks for putting me in the mix. And, you know, thanks for chatting. It's actually good, you know, in these times. You get to talk to a lot more people than I do. I'm just going to, you know, I named all the squirrels in my backyard. I'm working on their backstories right now.
Nice.
And spoiler alert, it's a very dark ending.
I look forward to the Telestrator breakdown of the squirrel movement in your backyard.
Yeah, for sure. All right, man. I'll let you go.
Okay. Thanks, Johnny. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.